You're listening to the free edition of Sweden in Focus from The Local. If you would like to listen to a full-length version of the podcast, as well as an additional midweek episode, please check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade to Membership Plus. Here's this week's free edition.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Sweden in Focus, a weekly news podcast made possible by members of The Local. We are recording this episode on Thursday, the 8th of June, and this week we'll be talking about the Swedish krona hitting new lows and when it's likely to recover. With the holidays coming up, we'll recommend a few places well worth a visit this summer. Also, Zlatan Ibrahimovic retired from football this week after a hugely successful career, but his legacy off the pitch is also sure to leave a lasting impression. And we'll look at how there's a case to be made that he single-handedly changed Sweden. Finally, we'll discuss Sweden's complicated relationship with flags and what it is about Sweden that makes it a place worth celebrating. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and I'm joined today by James Savage in Stockholm and Richard Orange and Becky Waterton in Malmö. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
You all good?
Yeah, really good. Thank you.
I've been busily trying to choose what kind of fencing I'm going to have on my allotment. So it's been a very busy week.
Hang on. Just keep the small talk very short. Come on.
Okay, sorry.
Richard, that was impeccable. You didn't say anything.
He's just on an eyebrow raise.
Yeah, that doesn't work in radio. No, I'm being mystisk, as they call it in Swedish.
Okay. They don't call you Mystic Richard for nothing.
I bought a fridge.
That's quite...
Not very exciting.
That is quite mystic.
Becky, you've been filling our group chat with sex and lies this week. Can you please explain?
Yes, I will do my best, although the entire story is quite bizarre. So essentially, rumours are going around in international media that Sweden has just made sex an official sport and is celebrating that by hosting the European Sex Championships this week. There are two stories here. The first one is to claim that Sweden has made sex an official sport, and I'm very sorry to break it to you, but it hasn't. What has happened is that the very official-sounding Swedish Sex Federation applied to become a member of the Swedish Sports Confederation, Riksidrottsförbundet, late last year. So if that had been accepted, I guess sex would have become an official sport in Sweden. One of the most entertaining things about this whole story is actually reading the application and the Sports Confederation's response to it. I managed to find it. The Confederation asked for kind of, do you have your accounting books for the past 3 years? Can you give us a list of your members? And can you give us a detailed description of the rules of competition? And they also, this really made me laugh, they also asked if the Sex Federation's members were föreningar eller fysiska personer, so like clubs or physical people. I was like, I suspect they are quite physical, actually. But anyway, the Sex Federation, they call themselves the Sex Federation, self-proclaimed Sex Federation, never submitted these extra documents, meaning that their application was just rejected straight out, and the Confederation never had to consider whether sex actually should be considered a sport or not. But I suspect it probably wouldn't have been considered a sport. Anyway, what is true is that the Swedish Sex Federation is holding a European Sex Championship, although it is not at all supported or approved by the Sports Federation. It is just some people having sex live on camera for an online audience in an undisclosed location somewhere near Jönköping.
Basically a gross old sex party then.
Yeah, it's just some people having sex on camera for, you know.
It's like chess. It's like chess, isn't it? Is it sport or is it just an enjoyable activity?
Or golf or snooker, yeah.
Now, there is also this even more bizarre disinformation aspect. Sweden has a habit of, you know, calling anything a disinformation campaign, but they actually might have a point here. So the incorrect version of this story has been spread by Russia Today. It's been spread by some Arabic language media abroad, and it's been used to kind of illustrate Swedish decadence, Swedish hedonism, general immorality, that kind of thing. And it's also been picked up by quite a few Indian newspapers, perhaps in part due to the fact that the judging guidelines for the competition state that the highest scoring category is for the couple who are most artistic, according to the Kama Sutra, among other things. But yeah, unfortunately, any international media, if you're listening, this is all not true. It's not official. It's not an official sport. And this so-called European Sex Championship is just one guy that's decided to try and make this a thing.
I do think this is representative of a lot of those stories you see in the international media about Sweden. Sweden has this sort of like reputation as being this, you know, ridiculously ultra liberal place. And I think that there are quite a lot of countries, there are quite a lot of people out there who like publishing these kind of stories to kind of discredit Sweden. I think we've seen it before, and you know, it discredits Sweden in all sorts of ways, particularly though if you don't like Sweden's foreign policy, you discredit Sweden's morality. And, you know, I think, you know, the fact that Sweden's reputation in so many areas precedes it makes it a bit of a target for this kind of thing. And I think this is not the first time we've seen this.
Yeah,
kind of
and
thing.
It's not the first time Swedes have been portrayed as naked, sex-loving people. Like, yeah. This has been going on for, like, decades.
There's that brilliant film, what's it called? The Italian Mondo Doc, like a...
Sweden, Heaven or Hell.
Yes, exactly.
It's absolutely brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Do look it up. It's fascinating. You can find it on YouTube, but it's not dirty. So you can.
I think there might be some boobs and bums
safely. There might be some boobs and bums, but not dirty by Swedish standards.
But I think we have an article about it as well in our archives somewhere.
So we do.
Yeah, well, well done for doing all the due diligence on this and actually finding all the documentation. I read your article yesterday. It's really, really good read, and we'll put a link to that in the notes. We've all got summer on our minds at the moment, and I've seen some concern in Sweden that we could be facing another summer like the one in 2018, when we had record temperatures, rampaging wildfires and weak harvests. What are the experts saying, Richard? Is there a cause for concern?
Yes, there is, I think. The Swedish state weather forecaster, SMHI, has a map of fire risk, and pretty much everywhere south of Gävle is sort of classified as dry, very dry, or extremely dry. But if you look at the fire risk, it's much more centered around Stockholm, going west all the way through Dalarna and Värmland to the Norwegian border. So that sort of central belt of Sweden is at a big risk of forest fires right now. And then the dry bit goes all the way down, just inland from the west coast, all the way down to Karlskrona. So that area presumably will be at risk quite soon. And SMHI doesn't seem to have a drought warning system, but Denmark state forecaster does. And they've been warning of a drought as bad as 2018. So they've been saying that the risk of a drought has only been higher twice in the last decade, 2008 and 2020. So it's actually worse now than it was at this point in 2018. And Denmark's, and I think Sweden probably as well, now gone 2 weeks without rain for the first time since about 2006. So it's a big risk. And even if it does start raining in June, and it doesn't look like it's going to, the water levels are already so depleted from the last month's lack of rain that even if it's normal rain in June, there'll still be a drought risk. So it needs to be torrential rain in June to sort of catch up. So it's not looking good. And Swedish radio has been interviewing people from the Swedish Board of Agriculture and the Swedish Farmers Federation, who were all saying this year's harvest is going to be pretty bad, more like 2018. I went out, actually, I did a story in 2018 and went out and visited lots of farmers. And it was quite shocking. It was like, you know, the crops were all wilted. You know, there were hardly any... hardly anything on any of the wheat. It was just kind of
shriveled. They had to put down some animals as well, didn't they? Because they didn't have enough food or water for them.
Yeah, exactly. They had to put down loads of cows because they couldn't feed them. And I think they couldn't even use the meat. Yeah, so it's not looking good. Hopefully it does rain, but yeah, it's not looking great.
Okay, thanks for that. And yeah, we'll link to any stories on that in the notes. And another thing on people's minds as we plan our summers is the weak Swedish currency. The krona plummeted to its lowest level in 15 years this week in relation to the dollar and the euro. And I spoke to Alexandra Stråberg, the chief economist at Länsförsäkringar, which is one of Sweden's biggest insurance companies and a bank, about why the krona is continuing to struggle and if and when we can expect it to recover.
I think there are several reasons for the weak krona. First of all, the currency market is highly affected by what's going on in the world. If there's a crisis or insecurities, then the market tends to move to safer currency havens like the dollar. And if we look back a couple of years, we have had the pandemic, we have had the Russian invasion of Ukraine. All these things make smaller currencies less attractive to invest in. I also think it's about there are expectations of the economy, and the market is expecting a weaker performance for the Swedish economy if you compare to the euro area and the US. A third reason might be that we have a very high interest rate sensitivity among Swedish households. So many of them own their own housing, and most of them have variable interest rates. So that means that they're very sensitive to interest increases. And that seems to be perceived as a very important risk for the economy, and a much higher risk than, I mean, if you look at the public sector and our national debt and those things, that's super strong. Yeah. But that's not perceived as much of a strength as the interest rate sensitivity is perceived as a risk.
Sure. And is there any particular reason that it's so low at the moment? I mean, it reached like a 15-year low in the past few days.
I think it is due to all these things combined, and also together, because what came out beginning of last week was that we are expecting a weak performance of the economy. And that implies then that the Riksbank might not be able to raise the interest rate in the same pace or at the same level as ECB, for instance.
And is there anybody who benefits from the weak krona?
Well, I think that maybe the Swedish government should put some money into advertising Sweden as the big tourist attraction this summer, because I do think that the foreign visitors would benefit from the weaker currency. I mean, for instance, for an average European tourist, his or her purchasing power in Sweden would have increased some 10% over the last year. And also another sector would be the exporting companies, the exporting sector. They would benefit from the weak currency to some extent.
This has been going on for quite a long time now. What's your prognosis for the krona? Is Sweden's currency going to strengthen anytime soon?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, first of all, you should say that forecasting currencies is very difficult. I mean, period. And I do think that the SEK is undervalued, but unfortunately, that's not enough to drive the krona any higher. And we don't really see the drivers for the weakening of the krona to change direction anytime soon. And the problem is that if, let's say, recession fears or financial instability reemerge, then the krona tends to perform poorly. So in the long run, though, if we could put this in sort of a hopeful bucket or on the hopeful side, we do expect the krona to strengthen. But I do think that's a topic for next year at the earliest.
That was Länsförsäkringar's chief economist, Alexandra Stråberg. And as she said, one of the consequences of the krona slump is that the tourist industry is expecting a bumper summer, in that foreign tourists' money will go further in Sweden, and those of us who live here are less likely to travel abroad. And with that in mind, we thought we'd look at some day trips from the biggest cities that we can recommend. And can I start with you, James? If you live in Stockholm, where should you be headed on a fine summer's day?
There's almost an embarrassment of riches around Stockholm in the number of places you could go to. I mean, the obvious place to start is the archipelago. I mean, get on a boat and pretty much go anywhere you like. It's just beautiful out there. But if I'm going to pick two places to go to, slightly different kinds of places, one place that's just fun and fab is Sandhamn. So that's kind of on the outer edges of the archipelago. It is, as the name indicates, a sandy island. You can get there by fast boat from Stavsnäs. That's probably the easiest way to get there. You can take a bus to Stavsnäs and then a fast boat from there. You can take a slow boat from the center of town, but then it takes, I think, a couple of hours. So it's where the sort of rich brats go with their fancy boats, and it's got a couple of nice hotels, and but is also just beautiful. Another place is a bit more, so you've got a bit more to yourself, or at least it's a bit less fancy pants and a bit more sort of grounded is Grinda, which is about an hour away from Stockholm, and it's beautiful. It's also got, I've chosen it because it's also got a pub, and for me, you know, you kind of, if you're not very good at picnics, it's kind of an essential element. Two other places I would recommend: Mariefred, which is where Gripsholm Slott is. That's an inland trip, sort of on Mälaren. Absolutely beautiful. This Gripsholm Slott from the Gustav Vasa era, this fantastic castle that's also home to the Swedish National Portrait Gallery. Absolutely worth going to see. And a beautiful town on Lake Mälaren. Another place is Sigtuna, north of Stockholm. A beautiful town, historic town, proper old Swedish wooden town. You know, very important place in Sweden's history as well. So those are the places that I would visit. But really, you know, take your car or a train and point it in any direction, or a boat, and point it any direction from Stockholm, and you've got a great day out.
Absolutely. Really good tips there. And I'll do Gothenburg because I've spent a lot of time there. And I have to say, you mentioned the Stockholm archipelago. The Gothenburg archipelago is also spectacular. And I especially love going to the northern islands. My wife's family used to have a house there on a small island called Kalvsund. And it's just glorious there during the summer. A couple of hundred people live on the island year round. And then there's another 100 or so who move in for the summer. There are no cars, not a whole lot to do except go for lovely walks around the rocky shoreline, fish for crabs, or jump off a pontoon and swim in the salty water, which is a novelty when you're coming from the more brackish Baltic. Then there are bigger islands nearby like Ökerö and Hörna, which are bustling during the summer and where you can find plenty of really good seafood restaurants. Another tip would be to travel a bit further north again over the bridge at Stenungsund and onto the island of Orust. There are some old fishing villages there like Mollesund and Hellevik Strand that are like poster children for all of Western Sweden. And I'd also recommend a place called Slussens Pensionat, which is a restaurant on the northern tip of the island, which hosts concerts during the summer. And people from Gothenburg will always tell you that the West Coast is the best coast. And honestly, it's hard to argue. I do love it around Stockholm too, but here I'm drawn sort of just as much to the lakes as the sea. But the seaside on the West Coast is amazing. So that was Gothenburg. How about you, Becky? Where do you recommend for anyone planning to get out of Malmö for a day?
Yeah, so Emma actually wrote an article on this last week, which I will unashamedly rip off here, although I have actually done quite a few of these day trips. Staying on the archipelago topic that you guys were both mentioning, we don't really have an archipelago here, but we have this very sweet little island called Ven, which is pretty much Skåne's only island, which absolutely makes up for not having an archipelago. It's quite a big island. For a day trip, you can drive or take the train to Landskrona from Malmö, and then you can get the ferry over to the island, where you can rent a bike, cycle around the lovely countryside. There's a museum there dedicated to Danish 16th century astronomer Tycho Brahe. I don't know how you would say that in English. Tycho Brahe, I guess.
The island. I'd say it in, yeah, Tycho Brahe.
Tycho Brahe. The island was Danish until 1660, so that's why it's there. He was actually given it as a present. There's also some nice cafes and restaurants. There's even a distillery called Spirit of Ven. Obviously, you can't take any of their booze home with you, but they do sell their spirits in sustainable lagers, so you can pop into Landskrona on the way home and pick some up.
Very good.
Österlen is also nice. It's popular for summer house owners like Richard and is known for being very picturesque. It's probably easiest to get around by car, where you can visit small villages like Brantevik, Fyllinge, Korsaberga. There's a castle, Glimmingehus Slott or castle, and there's apple orchards in Skjevik you can visit. Those travelling by public transport, it's probably best to get the train to Simrishamn for a nice day out there. Finally, you can hop over to Copenhagen for the day. To avoid this podcast becoming Denmark in focus, I will just tell you that we can find more information on that.
Thank you, Becky. Thank you.
Yes. You can find more information on that and a couple of other day trip ideas in our article in the notes. And I did also just write an article for the local Denmark on how to have a cheap day out in Copenhagen. So if you want to do that, you can check there.
Okay. Thanks very much for that. And we also do have articles in our archives with day trips from Gothenburg and Stockholm. We'll link to both of those as well.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Oh. And now, one of the biggest stories in Sweden this week surrounded the retirement of Zlatan Ibrahimovic from top-level football when he was given an emotional send-off by AC Milan fans at the San Siro to bring the curtain down on a career that took him from the suburbs of Malmö to many of the top clubs in European football. But obviously, he's much more than just a footballer. His larger-than-life personality has made him one of the most compelling and controversial figures in Swedish public life over the past two decades. And people with immigrant backgrounds in particular have been talking this week about what Zlatan Ibrahimovic meant for them growing up in Sweden. Richard, can you explain why so many people in Sweden hold him up as a role model?
I think he just showed that people with immigrant backgrounds could be sort of cocky, pushy, and have this kind of sense of humour when they were dealing with journalists or on the public platform, because that they didn't need to copy this sort of Swedish reserve and self-effacement. They didn't need to be this kind of logon person, that they could be Swedish in a completely different way. And I think that for people with immigrant backgrounds, I think every time he appeared on TV and like wound up the Swedish media by being like outrageously arrogant or saying something, you know, funny and combative and cocky and really cheeky, they all sort of cheered inside, because you suddenly think, oh God, it's so fresh. You know, you're so used to like Swedish people on TV just being, you know, not really, not going there. And he just did it completely yeah. differently. And everyone was just like, wow, it's so liberating. So there was an article in Svenska Dagbladet by the journalist Elaf Ali. And she describes seeing Zlatan when she was growing up in school, almost a bit like seeing the Sex Pistols for the first time. You know, she still, yes. still, when I grew up, there was like no one I could see myself in. Then Zlatan came and changed everything. And then the punchline is brilliant. She goes, it wasn't long before my teacher called me in for a meeting. So it's hard to imagine. I don't know how she started behaving differently, but it was definitely more caxig, more cocky. And I think he's got such an incredible way. I think what people underestimate with Zlatan is that he's very smart and he's very funny, and people just think it's arrogant. But he's kind of playing with the journalists, and he's taking the piss quite a lot. I think he's not. I mean, he obviously doesn't have a small ego, but he's also self. There's an element of self mockery, I think, you know, as well.
Yeah.
But what I like is I think it might be the Young Zlatan documentary, and there's this brilliant interview. I mean, I don't get football at all. I've got like, I just don't, it just people running around on a pitch. it just means nothing to me watching other people play a game. But they interview him, and I think he's talking about his first big goal at one of the big European teams he went to. And he describes how he had been struggling before to make an impact, and it hadn't been working for him. And then he's such a great storyteller. He just kind of explains how the crowd was there, and then he just describes how he moved around on the pitch and what happened and how the crowd reacted and how the other players reacted. And then he comes to the bit where he just shoots the goal in. And I've never had anyone explain an element of football to me in a way that made me really understand why people love it so much. And I was going looking for some quotes, and there was one when he got engaged to his then fiance, and the journalists go, well, vad fick hon som, you know, as a present? And he goes, vad hon fick? What did she get? Hon fick Zlatan. She got Zlatan. So just where I live in Rosengård, they've got this big mural, and it says, they've got Zlatan's smile. And it says, you can take the kid from Rosengård, but you can't take Rosengård from the kid. So I think when he, especially in the early days, when he was maybe the beginning of his international career, he was seen as a kind of role model, and they kind of used it to try and tell people in Rosengorge, you know, you can be like Zlatan, you know, you can, there's a possibility, you can make a life for yourself here. I think you can be pretty certain that this is not the end of Zlatan. Like, even if it's the end of his football career, he's got such a personality that I think he will, I don't know what he'll do, but he'll do something.
But that article from Elaf Ali was just, it was a really well-written article, and she explained so well how she had gone from being this sort of mousy personality, and then she found that she could be her whole self because she saw somebody else with an immigrant background who was doing that.
But I think a lot of immigrants feel that. If I look at my daughter at school, and a lot of her friends are from other backgrounds, like African backgrounds, and they're much louder than the Swedish kids. And so there is this pressure, like, don't be so loud, you know, because, you know, you're from a noisier culture. When you're at home, it's noisier. And then you come out to school and suddenly it's like quiet. Mat rule. You have to have mat rule when you eat, you know, you have to. And suddenly Zlatan is like, no, you don't. You can be kaxig as you like. I don't know.
Yeah. And he's stirred up so many debates over the years about what it means to be Swedish. And in a country where 25% of the population has an immigrant background, these debates around identity personified by him will continue to reverberate in Sweden, not least at this time of the year when students take to the streets to celebrate their graduation from gymnasiet or upper secondary school. And a section of Swedish opinion invariably gets upset about teenagers waving national flags that aren't Sweden's. James, you pushed back against this on Twitter this week, arguing that it's perfectly fine to have dual identities and to express them publicly. First off, who gets upset by this and why?
Well, obviously the people who get most upset about it are people sort of on the far right, I suppose you would call it, you know, the populist right, the nationalist right. So I was just watching on the way here, I was watching this clip from a guy called Joachim Lamotte, who is a journalist, but also I'd say these days, you know, kind of quite associated with the sort of populist right. He'd gone to film a student graduation in Gothenburg, I think it was, and he was filming kids who were obviously a little bit pissed and waving, pissed in the drunk sense, and waving flags, Kurdistan flags. And he was, you know, in a quite a provocative way, asking them why they were waving Kurdistan flags. And there was one girl who responded in a very drunken slur. She responded, "Fuck Sweden." And of course, this was all clipped out, and it was presented as, you know, this girl and therefore as a representative of these kids in general, you know, not liking Sweden and being sort of anti-Swedish, waving their foreign flags, being anti-Swedish. First of all, if you took that more in context, when you spoke to this girl's, when media went and spoke to this girl's friends and family, they're like, look, she was a bit drunk. It wasn't, she didn't mean anything by it. And he was actually being quite provocative in the way he asked the question. So, you know, I think it was very unfairly done in that respect. But I think it got quite a lot of publicity. And, you know, there was this underlying argument from some people that, you know, if you live in Sweden, you are Swedish and you wave the Swedish flag. There's only one flag to wave in Sweden, and that's the Swedish flag. And I just found that so depressing, because I think that, you know, if you come to another country, you might well take on the identity of that country, but you don't do it in a vacuum. You of course you bring your background with you, even if your parents came from another country, you know, they bring their background with them. And a lot of these kids were explaining that, you know, they were waving these flags for, in order to honor their parents. And, you know, particularly if it's a Kurdish flag or a Palestinian flag, they're doing it for, those are countries that have been, you know, but disappeared off the map for various reasons, and that no longer exist as countries. And the people who identify with those places, you know, feel that very strongly, and you can understand that. But I also felt that, you know, as a British person in Sweden, as someone from a rich, majority white Western European country, nobody questions my right to enjoy my Britishness when I feel like it, but also to be, you know, invited in to celebrate Swedishness as a Swedish citizen. You know, you're allowed to have both of those identities. You're certainly allowed to have your home identity with you in Sweden. And, you know, I felt, you know, I could raise a glass to the coronation and I can celebrate on Swedish National Day, and those two things aren't in conflict, but it feels that, you know, there are some people in Sweden who feel that for people particularly coming from poorer countries, people who are asylum, who've come here to claim asylum, or who have come as refugees, or whose parents came here as refugees, aren't allowed that privilege. And I think that's just sad.
What do you think, Richard and Becky? Does Sweden need to get better at accepting that identity is not always so black and white?
Yeah, I think so. I think Sweden needs to work really hard and get used to these kind of portmanteau terms like Afro-Svensk or Svenskedania or Svenska Assyria, and have a sense that you can have these dual identities. And I think part of the problem is that the demographic change in Sweden has come so quickly. And I don't feel that the idea of Swedishness or Svenskhet has really caught up with it. So in it's maybe over 30 years, it's gone to about 25% of the population has some kind of immigrant background. And whereas in countries like Britain or France that maybe have similar demographics, it's happened over a much longer period with a long sort of colonial history behind it. Whereas in Sweden doesn't have that history, and it was a very homogenous society, and now it's got 25% of the population from another country. And I think the way of thinking about ethnicity hasn't really caught up. So I think it's an enormous problem that there's this sort of ambiguity about whether Svensk refers to your citizenship or your ethnicity. And there hasn't been enough of a debate to try and to sort of establish what it means in the populations. I don't know what needs to happen. Either there needs to be a big publicity to campaign to talk about new Svensk and or new Swedes, or else maybe there needs to be a word that specifically refers to ethnic Swedes so that Svensk can be for the citizenship. I mean, in Kazakhstan, where I used to live, for example, Kazakhstani is people of the citizen, whereas Kazakh is the ethnicity. So Kazakhstan has, I think it's got, you know, millions of Koreans and Germans and Russians, and it's a real mixed bag of a country. But the Kazakhs are maybe 50%, and they're Kazakh, but everyone else is Kazakhstani. And there isn't that in Swedish, and I think it'd be quite good if there was. But I don't know how to do that. It's maybe not possible.
But I think it's come a long way. I'd say a couple of things here. I think it's come a long way since I first came to Sweden, where people, media, spoke about svenskar och invandrare as Swedes and immigrants as two separate categories. And I don't feel that they do that quite so much these days. There's a lot more talk about ny svenskar, and you don't put Swedes and immigrants as two kind of distinct categories in the same way as I think you used to. But I think this idea of this sort of ethnic nationality is something that is quite deeply ingrained, and it's not just in Sweden. I think, you know, in Germany, for example, you know, there's long been this idea of, you know, of what you know what an ethnic German is, and it's defined sort of by it's defined by language and by history and by ethnicity. And so, you know, someone living outside of what are the German borders would be seen as German. And, you know, if we go back into the 20th century history, a lot of problems have been caused by this. But you know, I think if you read 20th century history about Germany, you get an idea of what, you know, of how Swedes have also traditionally looked at ethnicity. You know, it's not Swedishness, it's not about a civic nationality, it is about an ethnic nationality. And, you know, it just takes time to move on from that. But I think that we, you know, a lot has happened in the last few decades, and it's not going to change overnight, but maybe a campaign would help.
I think it's really interesting what you were saying, James, about like people with immigrant backgrounds getting criticized for not waving Swedish flags, but they're the same people that the far right would say aren't Swedish. You know, it's like they're Swedish on the one hand because they have to have a Swedish flag, but then they're not Swedish enough to call themselves Swedish. I think that's quite an interesting thing as well.
Yeah.
We criticize aspects of Sweden on this podcast, but we all fundamentally have a lot of positive experiences of the place as well. And I celebrated National Day this year by listening to the anti-racism organization Expo's podcast. That's how much fun I had. I did some other things too. And they had a really, really good episode about Sweden's complicated relationship with the 6th of June and how people still don't really know how to celebrate it. But one of the most interesting things the panelists discussed was whether it was possible to embrace a kind of positive patriotism as an antidote to a toxic nationalism fueled by condescension and xenophobia. And They gave some examples of things about Sweden that made them happy and proud. And we thought it would be nice to also take that positive view and chat a bit about what we think makes Sweden a place worth celebrating. Becky, can you start us off?
I can. But I think for me, a lot of it is about like solidarity. And I don't necessarily mean that in like a political sense, although I'm sure it's been influenced by the fact that Sweden has been social democrat for quite a lot of recent history. But it's just things like Swedes are quite closed off. But once you get to know them, if you ask for help, they very often will help you. You know, a few days ago, I was cycling to work and there was someone who had fallen off their bike. You know, this was in rush hour. There were four or five people all standing around. When I was cycling, I didn't stop because there were people helping already. But I heard someone saying like, oh, let's call an ambulance. They were all helping. And I'm sure they were all on their way to work or something, you know, like, and I just think that this whole solidarity, like this idea of, you don't often hear Swedes grumbling about paying taxes because there's this whole concept of like, yeah, well, we're paying into this system. It helps everybody. Like you have the welfare state, that kind of thing. And I think a lot of that is Swedish culture. If I need help, if I, you know, my neighbor came and asked to borrow some sugar, and people talk so much about how like you never talk to your neighbors in Sweden. But I don't know if I agree with that. I think if you ask for help from a Swede, they will help you.
Yes.
And I think that's a really good thing to celebrate. Mm.
They love a crisis.
Swedes love a crisis.
they love socializing by doing stuff. They tend to find it quite difficult to just like chat for no reason.
Yeah.
But you get like a burst pipe in your apartment and all of your neighbors will be working together.
Mm. Yeah. I think people, Swedes get a bad rep for not being helpful. And I think they are quite helpful.
when it needs to happen, they're helpful. They're not going to have a chat with you in the grocery queue very often.
No.
But you know, they will look out for other people when it matters.
I mean, that also comes from a place of respect. They're not doing it to not be friendly. They're doing it because they think, okay, this person's busy. I don't want to disturb them with my small talk kind of thing.
It's this individualist society, which in many respects is a great part of Sweden, a great aspect of Sweden. Mm. You know that you are an individual. You're seen as an individual. You have autonomy, and that autonomy is respected and promoted. Mm. And you know, quite a lot of the system of, you know, the very generous social welfare system, which, you know, you can have opinions on and all sorts of opinions on. But you know, the idea that it's there to help protect individuals' independence, so you're not dependent on family or, you know, inheritance or your employer. You are an independent individual, and the system is designed to help you maintain that independence. Mm-hmm. And that, the thought behind it is great. And you know, there are plenty of aspects in which it's imperfect, but I do like that sort of individualistic background.
Yeah, also education. Like I think there's very few Swedes that would be calling for you to introduce tuition fees for university. Because I think there's this kind of underlying argument that everyone should have the right to education. You should be possible that wherever you come from, you can become a doctor, you can become an electrician, you can become whatever you want. Like there shouldn't be a barrier there with education. I think that's also, I really like that as well, that everyone should have the same possibilities. Despite the fact that, like you said, it doesn't always work like that. But I think the thought there is still something to be admired.
Absolutely.
On a different note, one of the things I love about Sweden is the fact that it really leans into its traditions. It has, you know, for a country that kind of has a self-image of being very modern, and where the image from outside the country is that Sweden's very modern, it's actually also a very sort of traditionalist country in the sense that it really follows a calendar through the year of celebrations that they've celebrated year in and year out for centuries, and they really go for it. And you know, it will involve food, it will involve celebration, it will sometimes involve some alcohol, and we talked about that a lot in this podcast. But it's worth sort of thinking about in the round, because it really helps define what Sweden is. You know, from midsummer to crayfish parties to the way that they celebrate, you know, Easter and Christmas, it's all, you know, it's all quite regimented. There are some very obligatory moments in Swedish celebrations, but they give it a sort of regularity and a sort of, I find it a very sort of comforting kind of aspect of Swedish society. So for all of this stuff about Sweden being, you know, the social democratic side of it and the modernity, the traditionalism is also something that I really like. And also, you know, if you're talking about what Expo were talking about in their podcast, you know, a kind of Swedish patriotism. It's already there. They just don't see it. They don't see that when they raise a Swedish flag in their garden, they can't see that that's also, that is already a very sort of friendly, non-threatening form of Swedish patriotism. It's great. It's great. It's not tub-thumping, flag-waving. It's just a sort of peaceful, friendly and open kind of patriotism.
It's a very a very Swedish type of patriotism,
I mean, what I really admire about it is actually the social democratic side of the patriotism, in a way, in that coming from the UK, where the class system is just everywhere, it's almost like a caste system. You're sort of born into the ruling caste and sent to Eton, and then, you know, and I find it terrible. I hate the way it works in the UK. And in Sweden, it's there a little bit, but it's much, much weaker than in the UK and than most other countries in Europe. And even, you know, you can be the son or the daughter of somebody who, like, is a manual worker and then become culture editor of Sydsvenskan, and then your own son could become an electrician. You know, it's much more fluid between classes, but and there's much less of a sort of strong class identity. You know, obviously you wouldn't feel that if you spent the summer on Sandham, but it is much weaker than it is in the UK, and it's much less in the UK. When I go back, I'm always shocked. I'm immediately struck by it. Like, the first person I meet in the UK, I have to sort of negotiate class.
I think also you have respect for people. You know, everyone's seen as equal. It's not that you'd be like, oh, you know, her son's become an electrician.
Yeah.
You know, he's not going to uni. Mm.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
it's like, wow, okay, yeah, great, electrician, perfect. That's a great job. We need those skills. It's
their status in being an electrician, and I really like that. I think, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not just saying that because my husband is a manual working class worker.
Well,
I do have a lot of respect.
What about things like the long history of a democracy here, or Swedish feminism? Are these things that the country can be rightly proud of?
Yeah, absolutely.
Feminism, definitely. I mean, you know, in the long history of democracy, I mean, I guess I don't know about pride in the history of democracy. And I think, you know, we've got a lot of things with our democracy today in Sweden that I think we need to be very vigilant about. So I think that's less a source of pride and more a source of, concern and a need for vigilance. But certainly, you know, the fact that Sweden's come so far in gender equality is a great thing.
Even looking at my friends in Denmark, even my friends in the UK, Sweden is really, really good. It's a really good country to be a woman in. Like, I never had to consider whether I should stay home until my daughter went to school. I never had to consider whether I'd be going back to work. It was almost expected of me that I'd go back to work. And, you know, there can be issues with that as well. Maybe you want to homeschool and you can't do that in Sweden. But I do think that, like, I almost don't notice how gender equal Sweden is, because it's things that just make sense to me.
I think it kind of, the gender equality, I think, goes down to another thing that I really admire about Swedishness, which is historically when Sweden does stuff, they do it properly, you know, whereas in the UK, you can say, oh, yeah, we're gender equal, but do absolutely nothing to allow women to work and have children, you know, whereas in Sweden, you go, well, if we're going to be gender equal, then we need to do this and this and this and this. And then they put processes in place, they do the plumbing. You know, it's the same thing with like when they look at a house in the UK, they go, well, what about your plumbing? Why are the pipes on the outside? You know, they do the basics. they do the details. They make sure there's a element of Swedishness, which is maybe the school system is an exception, but generally when they do stuff, they do it properly.
Look at every
all the
time
way.
They make a new law, all of the utredning out, all of the experts that work. I mean, that one about permanent residence tests, that was like 400 pages long. I don't think there's many countries that would, just as part of a legislative process, get experts to write a 400 page long thing, listening to everybody from all different aspects of civil society, just to kind of make this proposal. Like, I think that's really
it's
impressive.
Amazing.
Even though it makes everything take ages.
Yeah, but it means that everything is done properly. Yeah.
It is very thorough. Although, you know, I think there are certain issues. I think there are certain issues there we talked about before about the legislative process that leave a lot to be desired. And, you know, the absence of a second chamber, the absence or the ability of a parliament to basically abolish democracy if it wishes with relative ease is another issue.
Governments have become adept at ignoring all of this advice.
You look at Lagrådet at the Council on Laws, which is supposed to be, you know, eminent judges who will tell the government whether something is appropriate from a legal perspective and follows legal principles, and they tell the government that something doesn't follow legal principles and the government does it anyway. Yes. So, all of this is good, but it's only as good as the respect that politicians have for it. And when they have less respect for it than they used to, it can be a problem.
Mm. But guys, we're meant to be positive. Oh. Only positive.
I was going to say, let's get back to the good stuff.
Yeah, but look, you've. I think it's so important that when you talk about the positives, that you also look at the other.
Yeah,
side
absolutely.
Of it. But most of this is over. This is an overwhelmingly a wonderful place to live and a well run place, and long may it remain so.
Thank you for listening, and do please tell people about the podcast if you think they might like it. Our panellists today were James Savage, Becky Waterton and Richard Orange. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and we'll be back again next week. Until then, take care.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
That's all for this week's free edition of Sweden in Focus. If you'd like to hear a full-length version of the podcast each week, as well as an additional midweek episode with more interviews and analysis, please upgrade to Membership Plus. Make sure to check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade. Sweden in Focus is a podcast by The Local Europe. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. The publisher is James Savage.